Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining us for today's Healthline 3. I'm Johnette Magner. Here we like to focus on ways to live a healthier and happier and, of course, a pain-free life if possible. We'll be taking your calls and answering your questions live in the studio today, and we will be opening our phone lines in just a few minutes. As a reminder, please make sure that you are in a quiet room when you call with your TV turned all the way down. Our phone number, if you want to write it down now, is 318-219-4569. And today's topic is, in fact, preventing heart disease. Good topic, something everybody needs to think about. And my special guest is Dr. John Davis. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's start with the obvious first question. How do I know if I'm at risk and need to be doing anything?
Not to be too funny, but if you're alive, you're at risk. And so, risk is an interesting topic to try to nail down all the, what are the risk factors? And so many people have some people have none. And so it's a really humbling disease sometimes. And so dating all the way back to autopsy studies from Vietnam, they did autopsies of soldiers killed in the line of duty and found that what becomes the precursors of plaque later in life was present in the early 20s. So we know we all have the substrate. We kind of have a predisposition to have plaque. And then it's really, what do we do, good, bad, or otherwise, to try to prevent that from developing as we age? And more importantly, how do we reduce the risk of what we can't control, which is the sudden change in plaque that then causes a clot, that then causes a heart attack, and then sometimes the manifestation of that is drop dead.
Right.
And so that's the most humbling presentation of heart disease. And so really prevention has to start early. You have to have an awareness of it. And we're hindered a little bit in healthcare by how to really convince people they're at risk at an age where they can really impact what they're trying to prevent. And so it's been said, and I think it probably could be true in the right kinds of places in the world where this is a preventable disease. Mm-hmm. As Western ways have infiltrated the world, the global impact of cardiovascular disease is being felt in places that really didn't have it before, India, China. And so we've taken our Western ways to them. They want our Western ways, which is usually franchised fast food sorts of businesses. And we've brought our diseases with us to them, or from us to them.
So basically the American diet, and I would imagine you top it with the Louisiana diet as well. And we all need to think about this.
Yeah, and I mean, it's consistency in being good. It doesn't mean you can't not do some of those things that we enjoy. I mean, there's nothing wrong with boiled crawfish, mm-hmm. for the most sure. part. It's all the other things that we sometimes associate with a crawfish boil, which is, you know, what a lot of people are doing this time of year, of course.
So what are the symptoms that we need to be on the lookout for, yeah. especially as we age, or if we are in a high-risk group at a young age?
I think it's any change, any new symptom. You know, I try not to use the word pain in the chest. I try to use discomfort. Do you have any type of discomfort? You know, a lot is made about differences between men and women and how they present with their heart. And still 80% of patients will say they had some sort of chest pain, but it's sometimes more subtle. So I tell patients any change in shortness of breath or discomfort in their chest could be an indicator of symptoms of their heart.
Are there common symptoms that are less obvious?
I think the number one thing sometimes that gets really misunderstood would be the worst indigestion of your life that kind of comes out of nowhere. Everybody's had some reflux. And that's the puzzling part for patients, because 90% of patients or more that come to the hospital concerned that they're having a heart attack are in fact not having it. But it's the dilemma that everybody faces when they're having these symptoms about what to do. And so, but I think GI symptoms are probably, is the answer to your question.
So if we look at various tests that, you know, we know the tests that are done when we conclude that you may be at risk, but are there tests that you can do along the way to just know generally if you are in good heart health or not?
I think that good heart health is a little bit different because it's the final product of all the upstream risk factors. And so, you know, the American Heart Association for a long time was advocating a campaign of know your numbers. Mm-hmm. And so I think that interacting with healthcare at a young age, you know, we kind of graduate from pediatrics at 18, and then people spend a pretty good amount of time healthy, but risk is accumulating. They don't know their blood pressure. They don't know their cholesterol. They don't know if they might be at risk for diabetes. And so we have absolute targets for numbers of things that we can measure and manage, again, to prevent this. We're incubators of sorts. We start, and if we have enough risk factors for a long enough period of time, you get the product.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about cholesterol.
Yes.
You have, you know, the single big number, but then you also have that breakdown between good and bad. What numbers should people begin to worry about in both of those areas?
Great question. Biologically, we probably need an LDL of 40. So then when I see somebody, I run with a guy, we've run marathons together, and if he hears this, he'll be mad at me probably, but I won't use his name. But he's healthy and fit, we're in our 50s, and his LDL is 140, and it bothers me. Mm-hmm. And so 140, he doesn't meet any metric for needing to take medications to manage his cholesterol. And I'll fast forward and say a marathon runner who is 79, who finished a 10K and had a heart attack after that I take care of, also had an LDL of 140. So the LDL at 140 at 50, if you lower that, you prevent the heart attack in the late 70s. If you're 35 and your LDL is 140. So there's two kind of branches of really prevention. There are people that are, you know, that I kind of listen to and follow who are longevity specialists. If you're looking for longevity and avoiding atherosclerosis, you take a statin, and we get rid of the numbers because the numbers are very challenging. I do this all the time in my office, and I sit next to you with fairly low cholesterol on a statin drug because I want to prevent atherosclerosis. I battle and play tug of war with my patients in the office about statin drugs. Still the most powerful, probably preventive thing that we can do to reduce long-term atherosclerosis. And I don't work for the pharmaceutical companies. They're all generic. There are other drugs that lower and manage cholesterol and LDL specifically. And there's a lot of stuff now about subtypes of HDL. So the lipid hypothesis is always in the crosshairs. LDL is the therapeutic target. I think most people, the vast majority, 99% or more people, think atherosclerosis is related to LDL. And so the LDL is really what we target. There's also lipoprotein little a, which is a different type of lipid. And it is, we all have sort of a set point of what our lipoprotein little a is. And so sometimes when I'm trying to convince somebody they got a problem and I'm looking at their basic lipid panel, then I say, well, let's do a lipoprotein little a and sort of see if there's more risk here than we recognized. Because it's not as commonly done.
All right, well, we have a caller right now. Charles, welcome to the program. What is your question for our doctor?
My question is, I don't know if he can answer it because he might be a heart specialist, sounds like, but let's say I'm sitting down now, I'm 88 years old, pretty good shape, can go about 2 or 3 rounds, but I notice that, say you fall down, I'll get chills. I get like sharp pains all through my legs and stomach and everything. But that's when you fall down. If I fall down, I don't get that. I just wonder what was caused that. When I see somebody else get hurt, I get chilled.
I think that's just your warm-hearted nature.
No, no. I'm pretty mean. But,
you must be doing something right. You're healthy at 88, and so I think that's a hard question that doesn't have an exact answer. And I think that we know that watching somebody else suffer can lead to stress and can cause certain sorts of heart things to occur. Why that doesn't seem to happen to you, I don't have a great answer for. Thank you for your question.
All right, and thank you, Charles, for giving us a call. You've been talking about LDL. Of course, people like me think bad and good. LDL's the bad.
LDL is the bad, and I think that more and more where HDL is good. We think that HDL tumbles along our blood vessels, and it does recycle the LDL. And so we think that higher levels of HDL are associated with cardioprotection. If you get the lipid experts to start debating, and then you can get into the weeds a little bit, but simply stated, the HDL is thought to be the protective of the two types of DLs, the HDL and LDL. And of course, people are looking at, some patients come to me and they have advanced lipid panels and all of this stuff, and it's information about some of those other things is emerging. At the end of the day, I'm left with trying to figure out, do I need to treat their LDL or not? And they've got all this mountain of information. And so I'm looking at them saying, what I have to offer is lifestyle changes, which can change lipids. But if people can sustain whatever behavior they're gonna sustain for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest hindrances with statin treatment, I'm talking a lot about statins, not intentionally, but is that you start it and then when do I stop it? Well, you don't.
You don't, yeah. Okay, I believe we have another caller. Jean, welcome to the program. And what is your question for our doctor?
I know that I saw somewhere in my medical records I have an enlarged heart, and I've already Googled causes. And mine is only that I've been overweight. I wanted to know if I start eating healthy and extra, and I'm overweight because I need two bad knees. And so if I start eating healthy and exercising more, especially after knee surgery, am I gonna shrink my heart or am I just gonna make it healthier?
You absolutely can have, depending on exactly what an enlarged heart is. I see a lot of patients who will have a chest x-ray done, and the interpretation may include enlarged heart, and then the way that sort of the lay public thinks about an enlarged heart is congestive heart failure. So if you have an enlarged heart, that maybe it may be wise for you to have an ultrasound of your heart called an echocardiogram to in fact determine, is your heart dilated or not? Because of course that's the implication of what it means to have an enlarged heart. And so I think a simple ultrasound of the heart can tell you that. And I will, obesity is a leading cause of congestive heart failure in the U.S. And so I think that having that evaluated, it would be important. Additionally, I think that yes, the heart can remodel in a positive way, meaning shrink, if you are identified to have an enlarged heart, and you go about the things that we can use to treat that. But there's never any penalty for having healthy habits.
Okay, thank you. I'm gonna start working on strengthening my heart.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for giving us a call. So, blood pressure, what does that tell you about your risk of heart problems?
It is the linchpin risk factor that's associated with everything that we want to avoid. number one risk factor for heart attack, number one risk factor for heart failure, number one risk factor for stroke. You name it, it's number one. So when I look at a study of heart attack patients, 80% will have hypertension listed as one of their risk factors. And so it's readily identifiable. It's with a blood pressure cuff. And so it's simple and, well, it's easy to evaluate, but it is the single most contributing thing to heart and vascular disease.
I'm embarrassed to say, I don't even know what your blood pressure should really be. Can you remind us of what those numbers should look like?
Normal blood pressure is 120 over 80 or lower. And what we've evolved to over time is we've gotten stricter with how we've labeled or diagnosed hypertension. So patients can have blood pressures from 120 to 130, and that's been labeled, I'm talking about the top number, that's been labeled elevated blood pressure, but not a diagnosis of hypertension. And then 130 to 140 on the top is stage one, 140 and above is stage two. So that's stricter than it used to be when I started in medicine 20 plus years ago now. And so it is very common. There's a lot of nuance to hypertension, though. If you're anxious or you think there's a problem and you're going to try to solve it with your blood pressure cuff, you'll probably see an elevated blood pressure.
Right.
Which is, and then when you check it again in 10 minutes and you're still worried about it, it will still be high.
So you're really looking at what would be kind of your normal day-to-day blood pressure, not the blood pressure spike that you feel when you suddenly become panicked about
something. That's right. And I think trends are what you're interested in, probably with all the health metrics. You know, an isolated LDL of this, and then you change your behavior and it becomes this. An isolated blood pressure of 140 isn't an emergency, but a sustained blood pressure over time is what we're trying to avoid. If your blood pressure is always 140, then it needs to be lower than that. And the treatment goals, if you do have hypertension and you're on medications, is to have a blood pressure average of 130 on top or lower than 80 on the bottom. And it is challenging to help people understand that it is treatable, but frequently patients need more than two drugs, three drugs. There's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of misinformation. I take this pill, it should cure it. Well, it's not that pill. And then hypertension also management invades into the realm of sodium. Mm-hmm. And we have a sodium problem in the world. Mm-hmm. It's the number one preservative in all food. Anything processed has sodium. We probably need 2 grams of sodium a day. We certainly recommend that or lower for hypertensive patients. And the average American has 4 to 5 grams mm-hmm. of sodium a day.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think we have another caller. Billy Joe, welcome to the program. What is your question for our doctor?
Yes, I have a question. Last year, I got really sick. My son took me to the emergency room. My body filled up with fluids real bad, and my whole body swelled up. I went to the emergency room. They said they ran all kinds of tests. They said I needed a blood transfusion because my blood was low. They said there was nothing wrong with my heart, but I'm still swelling up.
You're having swelling in your legs?
Yes.
You know, obviously swelling in the legs has been a sign of, you know, congestive heart failure, too much fluid. But in routine practice of seeing patients, lots of swelling I see in my office. And it can be caused by things that include the heart and many things that don't include medications. And sometimes, you know, it's more common than not that patients have vein problems in their legs, which is a different kind of vascular problem than artery problems. And so Of course, it sounds like you had anemia and they treated your anemia with a blood transfusion, but I think the swelling may be more nuanced than your heart, and certainly there are tests in the emergency rooms that are widely used to sort of screen patients for congestive heart failure. There's a test that's called BNP, and so sometimes, depending on your symptoms and chest x-ray and other lab findings, they can provide reassurance to you that this isn't coming from your heart. That being said, having swollen legs is uncomfortable for people, and there's a lot of different things, medication and non-medication, that can be done to treat that, and I hope that helps.
So what you're saying is you think it could be something with the heart?
That's exactly right. I mean, obviously, you're concerned about your heart, maybe your family is too, and you've had some reassuring information from other healthcare providers that said they thought your heart was okay. Now, if you haven't had a full battery of tests to confirm that, that may be necessary, but it could be coming from something that's not your heart. That's exactly right.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering my question.
You're welcome.
Oh, and thank you so much for calling us. A little bit of a curveball here.
Yeah.
Ozempic created for people with diabetes, but the weight loss has heart benefits too, because it lowers your cholesterol. Talk about how that product is actually improving people's heart health.
Boy, that's a good question, big topic, and one with a lot more data to come. And so we know that weight loss of any kind begins to invade and improve risk factors. So, you know, when I'm counseling somebody with hypertension and there is 10, 15, 20, 70, 100 pounds to lose, 10, 15, 20 pounds of weight loss is more powerful sometimes than their blood pressure drugs in treating their hypertension. So there's one. The metabolic syndrome, weight, lipids, blood pressure, prediabetes, you start losing weight and you change your metabolic inflammatory profile. And now that you can't measure that directly, but you can see it when you see the hemoglobin A1C come down. You can see it when they change their lipid parameters. Triglycerides go down, HDL goes up, LDL comes down. And so as you start to look at those drugs, absolute clinical trials in heart patients, BMI over 27, established heart disease and diabetes, indicated to reduce what we call MACE, major adverse cardiac events. So those are real things for real people. Putting it into practice, obviously much has been made in the media about shortages, but insurance companies are being more receptive to this. They have to be. But it's one of these things where, you know, patients go to the pharmacy and they get sticker shock because they want it to be less than it costs. And you know, there's a lot, you don't have to go too far to find people taking semaglutide and that aren't diabetic, that don't have all these risks. And we hope that reduces their cardiac risk. Nobody knows that for sure. They look better, they feel better with lower weights, and we can look at some of these parameters. Some caution about that class of drugs, I think, that's not talked about a lot, is osteoporosis for women. It may accelerate osteoporosis, and it does cause sarcopenia, loss of muscle mass. Mm-hmm. And so we just have to be careful about using these drugs, because they're not new drugs. Mm-hmm. They're the same drugs that have been in use at higher doses that have been shown to be effective in losing weight. And patients can lose 15 to 20% of their body mass or their weight, which for some people is a huge deal. mm-hmm. and absolutely transforms their metabolic risk.
So I have a family member who went on it, lost 40 pounds, and LDL dropped 50 points.
Yep.
Do you see yourself someday actually prescribing it potentially as a heart drug and not just a diabetes drug?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we have now two classes of drugs that we use as cardiologists, the GLP-1 agonist, the Ozempics, and those drugs. I guess I should say semaglutide, so I'm not being biased. That's the chemical name. And then we use these SGLT2 inhibitors, the gliflozins. We're using, those are diabetic drugs that are now used in congestive heart failure. So we, as cardiologists, are using these drugs. And we're recommending them because now we have outcome data. That's the buzzword in medicine. Can you prevent an outcome with a therapy? And so now we have outcomes data in these patients to use the GLP-1 agonists, the semaglutides, to reduce risk and reduce events.
Now it's very tempting, I'm sure, for patients to get on these drugs, get on statins, and say, now I can eat whatever I want. What do you caution patients about with respect to using these drugs alongside lifestyle changes?
As far as the semaglutides, most people will say they don't want to eat, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of the mechanism, or they have, you know, delayed gastric emptying and things, and so they eat less. So the message there is we all eat too much, mm-hmm. and so this drug is just helping us achieve that. And so when you start talking about the diets that people, you know, want to follow or not want to follow, you know, I've been guilty of this before. Several years ago, I was training for a marathon and didn't lose a pound.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got the, if it's calories in, calories out, I was matching my calories.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't lose a pound. I changed what I was doing for a host of other reasons, and there went the weight. And
yeah.
So, you know, and I think some people who exercise think that they're going to get away with eating whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the things that we know are true. They're tried and true. They're the things that your grandparents told us.
Right. So, but even if exercise alone, even if it's not for weight loss, has great heart benefits. So it should be done just for the sake of what it can do for
yes,
you.
Yes. You're still 150 minutes a week of aerobic exercise reduces your risk of one of these events that I've referred to before, 30-50%.
That's a lot.
So, you know, there's not many drugs. There are no drugs that we have that are that powerful. So yes, the message absolutely is to move. And there was a reassuring study for people that carry their phones around and count their steps. 8,000 steps a day can reduce the risk of a heart attack. So this 10,000 steps a day was something that came out of the 1964 Tokyo Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's reassuring for people because some people are proud to get 1,000 steps.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are proud to get 2. And I say, well, just get another 1,000, and there is some risk benefit or some benefit from doing that. So even small things done over a long time have a cumulative benefit.
And start small and build.
Absolutely.
Don't try to overdo it at the
outset. Absolutely. Too many people try to be the weekend warrior. And my biggest fear in my 50s is an injury that prevents me from being healthy. I got no time to be injured. And so many patients I see have chronic this, chronic that, and they're really stuck in a bad place where they want to do the right health behavior and they can't. And it doesn't have to be walking. I mean, it can be an exercise bicycle or whatever it is. But you know, there's a term, sedentarism, and we are too sedentary as a country.
For sure. Okay, where can people find you if they want to come see you?
My practice is at Willis Knight in Pyrmont. Pyrmont Cardiology is a specific practice, and that's where I am 5 days a week.
5 days a week. All right. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure visiting with you.
Yeah.
And we need to remind everyone that you're never too early. You're never too young to start taking care of your heart, making good choices. So thanks for joining us for Healthline 3, and have a good day.